Hello, this is Tejinder Singh for SCOTUS Blog, and this is our supercut of the audio from the same-sex marriage case. The justices heard 2.5 hours of oral argument in 4 consolidated cases on 2 distinct questions. First, whether the states are required to allow same-sex couples to get married, and second, whether states that don't permit same-sex couples to get married must nevertheless recognize marriages that are valid in other states. I'll introduce each segment before I play it for you. To start, the Chief Justice introduced the case, and Mary Bonato, counsel for the petitioners, got the argument underway.
We'll hear argument this morning in case number 14-556, Obergefell versus Hodges, and the consolidated cases. Ms. Bonato.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the intimate and committed relationships of same-sex couples, just like those of heterosexual couples, provide mutual support and are the foundation of family life in our society. Yet the legal commitment, responsibility, and protection that is marriage is off limits to gay people as a class.
Bonato argued that gay people should have the same right as heterosexual people to participate in the civil institution of marriage, but the Chief Justice asked whether it would redefine the institution itself to allow that right.
The argument on the other side is that they're seeking to redefine the institution. Every definition that I looked up prior to about a dozen years ago defined marriage as unity between a man and a woman as husband and wife. Obviously, if you succeed, that core definition will no longer be operable.
Bonato and the Chief Justice sparred over whether the opposite-sex relationship is fundamental to the institution of marriage. At that moment, Justice Kennedy, widely regarded as the likely swing vote in this case, asked his first question.
One of the problems is when you think about these cases, you think about words or cases, and the word that keeps coming back to me in this case is millennia plus time. First of all, there has not been really time, so the respondents say, for the federal system to engage in this debate, the separate states. But on a larger scale, it was about the same time between Brown and Loving as between Lawrence and this case. It's about 10 years. And so that's time for the scholars and the commentators and the bar and the public to engage in it. But still 10 years is, I don't even know how to count the decimals when we talk about millennia. This definition has been with us for millennia. And it's very difficult for the court to say, oh, well, we know better.
Justice Alito teased out Justice Kennedy's theme further, asking whether all of the societies that have not recognized rights to same-sex marriage should be regarded as engaging in invidious and properly motivated discrimination. His question earned this response from Bonato.
Your Honor, my position is that times can blind. And if you think about the example of sex discrimination, where, again, I assume that was protected by the 14th Amendment, but it took over 100 years for this court to recognize that a sex classification contravened the Constitution. But then, in short order, between Reed and Craig versus Boren, we went from a rational basis approach to heightened scrutiny, acknowledging that this kind of discrimination is invidious. And in the same vein here, we have a foundation of Romer, of Lawrence, of Windsor.
I don't really think you answered my question.
I'm sorry.
Can we infer that these societies all thought there was a rational reason for this and a practical reason for this?
I don't know what other societies assumed, but I do believe that times can blind, and it takes time to see stereotypes and to see the common humanity of people who had once been ignored or excluded.
From there, the conversation moved into the weeds a little bit, with various justices asking about particular other societies, and Bonato responding and trying to explain why in those societies the rule was really more as she favored it and why the American rule should be different. That prompted Justice Breyer to attempt to cut through the thicket.
Maybe you're doing that, but I would like to hear the precise answer to the question you've been asked several times.
Okay.
And it takes the form. The opposite view has been the law everywhere for thousands of years among people who were not discriminating even against gay people. And suddenly you want 9 people outside the ballot box to require states that don't want to do it to change what you've heard is change what marriage is to include gay people, why cannot those states at least wait and see whether, in fact, doing so in the other states is or is not harmful to marriage? Now, that same question has been put in many, many ways in the briefs on our subject. You've received it in three or four different ways. I would like to know, so I can hear and understand it, just what your response is.
In our system, you know, with the 14th Amendment, which, again, is sets forth principles that we all are governed by and govern our lives, when you look at examples like coverture, okay, even if it was not universal, it was still something that was widespread in this nation for a very, very long time, and that change in marriage was deeply unsettling to people. Likewise, even if race was not used as a basis for discriminating in every single state as a matter of law, by criminal law and constitutional law, it was incredibly pervasive. And again, changing that, as Virginia resisted in the Loving case, resisted and said, please wait and see. 80% of the American public was with Virginia on that. But again, it was the question of the individual liberty of the person to do something that was considered a profound change in its time.
2 minutes later in the argument, Justice Kennedy asked another question relating to whether the new social science about same-sex marriage should be disregarded as the court makes its decision.
Part of
wait and see, I suppose, is to ascertain whether the social science, the new studies, are accurate. It seems to me then that we should not consult at all the social science on this, because it's too new. You say we don't need to wait for changes. So it seems to me that if we're not going to wait, then it's only fair for us to say, well, we're not going to consult social science.
Well, 2 points on that, if I may. In terms of waiting, I do think the effect of waiting is not neutral. It does consign same-sex couples to this outlier status, and there will be profound consequences that follow from that. But then setting that aside, vis-a-vis the social science, there have been trials, of course, in the Michigan case, in Arkansas and Florida about adoption bans. These issues have been aired repeatedly, and there is, as you all have heard, a social science consensus that there is nothing about the sex or sexual orientation of the parent that is going to affect child outcomes. And this isn't just research about gay people. It's research about, you know, again, what is the effect of gender? It goes for 50 years.
Chief Justice Roberts acknowledged that waiting and seeing was not a neutral position, but he asked whether the states should be allowed to decide this question themselves, as opposed to having it decided for them by them.
On the other hand, one of the things that's truly extraordinary about this whole issue is how quickly has been the acceptance of your position across broad elements of society. I don't know what the latest opinion polls show. The situation in Maine, I think, is characteristic. In 2009, I guess it was by referendum, whatever, they banned gay marriage. In 2012, they enacted it as law. I mean, that sort of quick change has been a characteristic of this debate. But if you prevail here, there will be no more debate. I mean, closing the debate can close minds, and it will have a consequence on how this new institution is accepted. People feel very differently about something if they have a chance to vote on it than if it's imposed on them by the courts.
The questioning about democracy took a turn when Justice Scalia asked whether ministers who have religious objections to same-sex marriages would be required to perform those ceremonies. After reassuring him that they would not, Bonatto closed her argument.
That ministers will not have to conduct same-sex marriages.
If they do not want to, that is correct. I believe that is firm under the First Amendment. And I will say, just before I sit down, if I may reserve my time, Your Honor, that in terms of the question of who decides, it's not about the court versus the states. It's about the individual making the choice to marry and whom to marry, or the government.
Before Solicitor General Don Verrilli could get up to argue for the United States, a protester in the crowd made his opinions about the case known.
The Bible teaches that if you support gay marriage, then you can burn in hell for eternity. Homosexuality is an abomination to God. The judgment of God will come.
personnel hauled the protester away, and Don Verrilli got up to argue in support of the petitioners on behalf of the United States.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the opportunity to marry is integral to human dignity. Excluding gay and lesbian couples from marriage demeans the dignity of these couples, it demeans their children, and it denies that both the couples and their children the stabilizing structure that marriage affords. Now, the respondent's principal argument and what we've been discussing this morning so far is whether this issue of whether this discrimination should persist is something that should be left to the political process or whether it should be something decided by the court. And I'd like to make 3 points about that, if I could. First, I think it's important to understand that if this court concludes that this issue should be left to the political process, what the court will be saying is that the demeaning second-class status that gay and lesbian couples now inhabit in states that do not provide for marriage is consistent with the equal protection of the laws. That is not a wait and see. That is a validation. And second, to the extent the thought is that this can be left to the political process because this issue will take care of itself over time because attitudes are changing, what I respectfully submit to the court is that although no one can see the future perfectly, of course, that it seems much more likely to me that the outcome that we're going to end up with is something that will approximate the nation as a house divided that we had with de jure racial segregation. You may have many states, perhaps most states, in which gay couples can live with equal dignity and status, but you will have a minority of states in which gay couples will be relegated to demeaning second-class status, and I don't know why we would want to repeat that history. And third,
General, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And third, I want to just expand on what Ms. Bonato said, that and I think, Mr. Chief Justice, you did recognize this, that the decision to leave this to the political process is going to impose enormous costs that this court thought were costs of constitutional stature in Windsor. Thousands and thousands of people are going to live out their lives and go to their deaths without their states ever recognizing the equal dignity of their relationships.
Justice Kennedy asked the first question, inquiring whether times had changed since the court decided Lawrence versus Texas, a decision where Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion striking down sodomy laws.
Well, you could have said the same thing 10 years ago or so when we had Lawrence. Haven't we learned a tremendous amount since Lawrence, just in the last 10 years?
Verrilli's response to Justice Kennedy was a masterful example of flattery. He credited Lawrence versus Texas with much of the social change that's occurred since then and described the decision as a catalyst for allowing gays and lesbians to access the abiding guarantees of rights embodied in the 14th Amendment. The answer, however, failed to impress Justice Alito, who steered the conversation back toward the traditional definition of marriage.
What do you think are the essential elements of marriage as it exists today?
Well, I think the essential elements of marriage are the ones that are the obligations of mutual support and responsibility and the benefits surrounding marriage that state law provides to ensure that there is an enduring bond that continues over time and lasts hopefully till death do us part through the end of life. And certainly child rearing is bound up in that, but what I would suggest, Justice Alito, is that the way in which child bearing is bound up in that is quite different than what my friends on the other side are suggesting.
Well, let's think about two groups of two people. The first is a same-sex couple who have been together for 25 years, and they get married, either as a result of a change in state law or as a result of a court decision. The second, two people are unmarried siblings. They've lived together for 25 years. Their financial relationship is the same as the same-sex couple. They share household expenses and household chores in the same way. They care for each other in the same way. Is there any reason why the law should treat the two groups differently?
Verrilli recognized that there might not be a strong distinction between those two groups of people, but he pivoted back to what he described as one of the fundamental core components of marriage, the raising of children.
Well, I'm not entirely sure there would be, but of course marriage is something more fundamental than that. It is an enduring bond between two people, and to get back to the point about child rearing, I do think this is quite important. I mean, I understand, and in part of their wait-and-see and caution argument, that what respondents are saying here is that they want to exercise an attitude of caution because of concern about the welfare of children raised in same-sex married households. But there's a quite significant problem with that rationale, and it's this. Right now, today, hundreds of thousands of children are being raised in same-sex households. That number is only going to grow. All of the evidence so far shows you that there isn't a problem.
Burley closed his argument with an impassioned plea that the court recognize marriage equality and recognize it now.
In a world in which gay and lesbian couples live openly as our neighbors, they raise their children side by side with the rest of us, they contribute fully as members of the community, that it is simply untenable to suggest that they can be denied the right of equal participation in the institution of marriage, or that they can be required to wait until a majority decides that it is ready to treat gay and lesbian people as equals. Gay and lesbian people are equal. They deserve the equal protection of the laws, and they deserve it now.
Next, John Birch took the lectern for the respondents. He tried to frame the case as being about the courts deciding the question versus the people deciding it.
This case isn't about how to define marriage. It's about who gets to decide that question. Is it the people acting through the democratic process, or is it the federal courts? And we're asking you to affirm every individual's fundamental liberty interest in deciding the meaning of marriage.
Justice Breyer then asked a lengthy question about the rationale for denying access to marriage to same-sex couples. He postulated that it might simply be due to historical tradition or religious tradition. Birch disowned both of those answers and instead offered his own explanation.
Good. Our answer number one is that the marriage institution did not develop to deny dignity or to give second-class status to anyone. It developed to serve purposes that by their nature arise from biology. Now, imagine a world today where we had no marriage at all. Men and women would still be getting together and creating children, but they wouldn't be attached to each other in any social institution. Now, the marriage view on the other side here is that marriage is all about love and commitment. And as a society, we can agree that that's important. But the state doesn't have any interest in that. If we're trying to solve that social problem I just described, where there's no marriage, we wouldn't solve it by saying, well, let's have people identify who they're emotionally committed to and recognize those relationships.
This is Kagan, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor at this point all asked what harm it would do to heterosexual marriages or to the institution of marriage to open the institution to same-sex couples. That caused Justice Scalia to intervene and triggered an interesting back and forth between him, Birch, and Justice Kagan.
Excuse me, do you have to answer that question?
Under rational basis,
is it
we
your
don't.
Burden to show that it will harm marriage between a man and woman if you allow two men or two women to marry? Is that your burden? I thought your burden was simply to show that the state's reason for this institution is a reason that has nothing to do, that is inapplicable to same-sex couples.
Justice Scalia, you're exactly right, and that's why we prevail.
Yes,
but I want to answer your question, if I could.
I don't think that that's right. I think before something as fundamental to a society and to individuals as marriage, before an exclusion of this kind can be made in that institution, the state needs some reason for that exclusion.
And that's why I'd like to answer.
I'm giving you a real opportunity to tell me what that reason is.
Yes.
What is the reason for the exclusion rather than the reason for the non-inclusion?
Well, first, it wasn't a reason for an exclusion. It was a definition to solve a particular problem. But the reason why there's harm if you change the definition, because in people's minds, if marriage and creating children don't have anything to do with each other, then what do you expect? You expect more children outside of marriage. Now, I want to give you a hypothetical.
But
imagine two couples.
Do you think that that's what it would do, Mr. Birch, that if one allowed same-sex marriage, one would be announcing to the world that marriage and children have nothing to do with each other?
Not in the abstract, you know, or that concrete.
Well, not in the abstract, not in the concrete.
First teased out a hypothetical under which couples with different conceptions of marriage might pass those conceptions on to their children, resulting in a difference in out-of-wedlock birth rates. That caused Justice Kennedy to respond.
Same-sex couples say, of course we understand
the nobility and the sacredness of marriage. We know we can't procreate, but we want the other attributes of it in order to show that we, too, have a dignity that can be fulfilled. But you argued in your brief, and Justice Kagan was quite correct to say, is that you're saying that this harms conventional marriage. That was the argument you made in your brief, as I understood it.
Justice Kagan then proposed a hypothetical of a state that chose to restrict marriage only to couples that were interested in or capable of procreating. Bursch replied that such a regime would likely be unconstitutional, and Justice Kagan pressed him on whether he could reconcile that answer with his articulation of the rational basis rule.
Yeah. But you're the one who said that rational basis, pure rational basis, applies. And this is a state that's decided that it so wants this procreation-centered view of marriage that it's going to exclude people who don't want children, it's going to exclude people who can't have children. And the question is, would that be constitutional? And it seems to me it flows directly from your argument that it would be constitutional. But the problem is that we hear about those kinds of restrictions, and every single one of us said, that can't be constitutional. And I'm suggesting that the same might be true here.
That it can't be constitutional to keep the marriage definition that, as several justices have mentioned, has been rationally applied for millennia in every culture.
To keep the marriage definition, as you have described it, as so procreation-centered that a state can exclude everybody that does not serve that purpose for that reason alone. And that's the reason you've given.
That's the primary interest. But if you're concerned about the over-inclusiveness, the under-inclusiveness, the plaintiff's definition of marriage, other definition of marriages, suffer from that same flaw.
The conversation took a few turns, and the Chief Justice chimed in to ask whether the case could be resolved as a matter of sex discrimination as opposed to sexual orientation discrimination.
I'm not sure it's necessary to get into sexual orientation to resolve the case. I mean, if Sue loves Joe and Tom loves Joe, Sue can marry him and Tom can't. And the difference is based upon their different sex. Why isn't that a straightforward question of sexual discrimination?
The Chief Justice didn't follow up on his sex discrimination question, but Justice Ginsburg went back and forth with Bursch a bit about the meaning of the court's sex discrimination cases. Eventually, the conversation got its way back to Bursch's core ground, whether recognition of same-sex marriages has an influence on child welfare. At that point, Justice Kennedy got back into the fray.
I think the argument cuts quite against you.
But when I'm talking,
and it goes back to the basic point where you began, where you had some premise that only opposite-sex couples can have a bonding with the child. That was very interesting, but it's just a wrong premise.
That's not my premise. The premise is that we want to encourage children to be bonded to their biological mother and father. We don't deny at all, disagree at all, that same-sex couples can be bonded to their children. We hope that's the case.
But you see, this is what I think is difficult for some people with your argument, is that it's hard to see how permitting same-sex marriage discourages people from being bonded with their biological children.
As the argument continued, Bursch returned to his other core theme, which is that this matter should be decided by the democratic process and not by the courts.
Now, one of those is that when people have to act through the democratic process, it forces neighbors to sit down and civilly discuss an issue and try to persuade each other through reason, love, and logic. And we've already seen that happen in 11 states, and if you read some accounts, that could happen in many more very quickly. When you enact social change of this magnitude through the federal courts, it's cutting off that dialogue, and it's saying one group gets their definition, and the other is maligned as being irrational or filled with animus. And that's not the way that our democratic process is supposed to work, and there are long-term harms to our country and to that fundamental liberty interest to govern ourselves, all the things that this court talked about in the Schuette decision. If you take away that dynamic, if it's a court-imposed definition as opposed to one enacted by the people through the democratic process.
Justice Kagan responded to Bursch that although we do reside in a democracy, the Constitution is still the supreme law of the land. That led to an extended conversation between Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, and Justice Kennedy about some of the court's equal protection precedents and about the evolution of the institution of marriage over time. Ultimately, however, Bursch finished up right where we had left off, discussing again the need to leave these decisions in the hands of the people.
Your Honors, these are obviously very emotional issues where reasonable people can disagree. This Court has never assumed that people act out of animus when they're voting in the democratic process. The states, generally, Michigan specifically, has no animus and doesn't intend to take away dignity from anyone. We respect all parents, and we hope that they love their children. But this Court taking this important issue away from the people will have dramatic impacts on the democratic process, and we ask that you affirm.
Bonato delivered a brief rebuttal, which was relatively uneventful. After that, in a brief recess, the Court took up the second question presented, which is whether couples who have valid marriages in states that allow same-sex marriage have the right to have their marriage recognized in states that do not permit those marriages. Douglas Hallward Drehmeyer started the argument for the petitioners in that case.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the question two petitioners are already married. They have established those enduring relationships, and they have a liberty interest that is of fundamental importance to these couples and their children. A state should not be allowed to effectively dissolve that marriage without a sufficiently important justification to do so.
At this point, Justice Alito interjected that the arguments that the petitioners had made seemed very similar to the arguments made in regards to the first question presented. And that was curious because the premise of the second question presented is that the Court finds that states are not required to permit same-sex marriages. And so the hypothetical started to flow. Would a state be required to recognize a polygamous marriage from another state? Would a state be required to recognize a marriage of children in another state? Would a state be required to recognize a marriage between cousins in another state? Hallward Drehmeyer answered with the following legal test.
I think that the constitutional test is the one that the Court set forth in Zablocki, which is, does the state have a sufficiently important interest not to recognize it? And certainly in the case of incest, the state does.
A little later in the argument, counsel elaborated that the test was more stringent than the rational basis test that might apply to the first question presented, because the creation of a marriage also implied the conferring of dignity by the state, which another state was not free to disregard.
Our petitioners on question two are already married. We know from Windsor, because the Court held, that once married, a couple has a constitutionally protected liberty interest in their marriage. We also know from Windsor that where a sovereign disregards that marriage in a way that would be extraordinary and out of character with tradition, that requires, at the very least, careful consideration.
As the argument progressed, however, it became clear that not every justice understood exactly how the first question could be decided differently from the second. As counsel continued to argue that existing marriages merit extra protection, the Chief Justice especially found it difficult to apply that test in light of the assumption that the petitioners had already lost question one. And that led to another colloquy where it became clear that perhaps the two questions aren't as far apart as some might have originally believed.
That the marriage that our petitioners have entered into is a marriage. It is that same institution, that same most important relationship of one's life that this Court has held out as fundamental.
I mean, maybe I'm just repeating myself, but we only get to the second question if you've lost on that point already. If we've said states do not have to recognize same-sex marriage as a marriage. So assuming you've lost on that, I don't see how your argument gets — you can't say that they are not treating a marriage as a marriage when they don't have to do that in the first place.
Well, I think that that actually highlights one of the problems of trying to decide the two cases differently because, of course, deciding against petitioners on question one, even if the Court decides in favor of petitioners on question two, would forever relegate those marriages to second-class status and would raise all kinds of questions whether those marriages could be subjected to laws that are not quite so favorable.
You're re-arguing question one now? Is that what you're doing?
No, I'm suggesting, though, that even a win on question two does not fully validate our petitioners' marriages. But certainly we think that the state cannot disregard them, cannot effectively dissolve existing marriages without a sufficiently important reason for doing so.
In general, the questioning for this part of the argument was substantially less lively than the first part of the argument, and so counsel was left free to talk at some length about how he might treat this case differently from the first. In his closing, he offered an additional insight.
I think that it would be, in terms of the interest that distinguish between the two questions, it's helpful to think again, perhaps, about heterosexual couples. We don't think that a state could limit marriage to only those couples who are capable of procreation. We don't think it could preclude marriage by women who are 55. But it would be quite a different and distinct constitutional violation for the state to dissolve the marriages of opposite-sex couples when the woman reaches 55. I don't think that that's constitutionally permissible. The states don't do that, and of course they never would do that, because the essential protection against arbitrary laws is that the majority has to live under the same laws that they would subject the minority to, and there is no chance that the majority would subject themselves to such a law as that.
When Joseph Whalen stood up for the respondents, the first question came from Justice Scalia, who asked why Article 4 of the Constitution, also known as the Full Faith and Credit Clause, didn't dictate recognition of marriages from other states.
I'm so glad to be able to quote a portion of the Constitution that actually seems to be relevant. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. Now, why doesn't that apply?
Whalen essentially took the position that the Full Faith and Credit Clause does not apply to marriages, and therefore argued that a state was free to reject any marriage that was inconsistent with its own public policy. That position drew some criticism from the justices, and so Whalen retreated to a slightly narrower position.
I think the underlying focus is not just that there's a policy, but that there's a legitimate policy. And as this Court's questions earlier indicated, I proceed now on the assumption that the Court has decided the first question in the state's favor and has determined that, indeed, the state's policy to maintain a traditional man-woman definition of marriage is indeed legitimate, and we obviously agree that it is, and the Court should so decide.
Eventually, Justice Ginsburg joined the conversation and suggested that perhaps full faith and credit was not the appropriate framework under which to discuss the recognition of out-of-state marriages.
You're making a distinction between judgments. Full faith and credit applies to judgments. You can't reject a judgment from a sister state because you find it offensive to your policy.
But yes, Your Honor.
Full faith and credit has never been interpreted to apply to choice of law.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the distinction.
Yes, Your Honor. And so in essence, by deciding whether or not to recognize another state's marriage, the state is deciding whether or not to recognize the other state's law under which that marriage was performed.
There's a little bit more conversation about the Full Faith and Credit Clause involving Justice Sotomayor. However, shortly into it, the Chief Justice asked a question about how often the states actually exercise their power to refuse recognition of marriages.
Outside of the present controversy, when was the last time Tennessee declined to recognize a marriage from out of state?
Any marriage, Your Honor?
Any marriage.
1970 is the last one that I could point to. That involved a stepfather and a stepdaughter.
Mm-hmm. Whalen then clarified, however, that states are only hesitant to refuse recognition of marriages when those marriages fall within the traditional man-woman format. Other marriages, he argued, are different.
The justifications that have grown over time and the requirement for a strong public policy reason to decline to recognize a marriage have grown up around the man-woman definition. Our position is that so long as we're talking about a marriage from another state that is not the man-woman definition, that it is simply the state's interest in maintaining a cohesive and a coherent internal state policy with regard to marriage that justifies not recognizing those marriages.
Alluding back to the full faith and credit conversation, Justice Ginsburg raised an interesting point, which is that divorces are recognized across state lines, yet marriages, under the respondent's argument, would not be.
And
it is odd, isn't it, that a divorce does become the decree for the nation. A divorce with proper jurisdiction in one state must be recognized by every other state, but not the act of marriage.
I understand the point, Your Honor, and again, I think it falls within the court's recognition of a distinction between judgments and laws. And here I think we're dealing only with laws. And again, it would allow one state, initially, literally one state, and now a minority of states to legislate fundamental state concern about marriage for every other state, quite literally.
The remainder of the argument was relatively uneventful. Whelan concluded, and Hallward Driemeier gave a rebuttal, where he stressed the federalism implications of rejecting marriages from another state and the discriminatory effect of denying recognition only to same-sex marriages. One thing that's notable about the argument in the second question presented is that, as you heard, Justice Kennedy said almost nothing, which may indicate that he thinks that all of the action is in the first question presented. Indeed, all of the justices seem to agree that if that question is resolved in the petitioner's favor, then there's no need to even reach the second question, and so the court may ultimately wind up not deciding it. We'll know more once the opinion is issued in June. For SCOTUS Blog, I'm Dajinder Singh. Thanks for listening.